Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. This is the day we connect you with reporters to discuss coverage of the week's news. On Wednesday, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates released the Obama administration's military and weapons budget. Worldwide headlines which lead you to believe that the budget is being drastically cut. The Financial Times headline read, "Gates takes on the defense industry." The Wall Street Journal's, "Obama and Gates cut the military." The administration has made proposed cuts to a number of weapons systems, but this budget is actually 4% higher than the Pentagon's $513 billion budget under the Bush administration. Jesse Freestein has been covering the military and weapons budget for the Real News Network. That's an independent, member-supported TV news and documentary network. Jesse also recently returned from El Salvador, where he was covering the elections there. On March 15th, El Salvador made history by electing the first left-wing president in its history. And Jesse Freestein joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Dave Zirin, the first ever sports writer for The Nation magazine. Dave's latest piece is called The Meaning of Michigan State. It looks at the connections between sports, employment, and really shedding a light on a city that's been hit especially hard by the economy. Dave writes, in hard times, sports can play a role that's both positive and progressive. Dave Zirin is also the host of XM Satellite's popular weekly show, Edge of Sports Radio, and he's author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to have you. And a little later in the show, we'll be joined by Rekha Basu. She's a columnist with the Des Moines Register. She'll be talking to us about the recent decision, or the recent ruling, I should say, legalizing gay marriage in Iowa. She'll be joining us later in the show. So as we always do on Friday, we like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who put out a piece this week that was done well. So, Jesse Freestein, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
All right. Well, I don't know how positive it is, but I think a good piece that was put out was one by Jeffrey Sachs, the economist. And it's interesting to see people like Sachs and Stiglitz, some of these big-name economists who served a really important role over the past years in sort of soothing our consciousness about what all these financial institutions were up to, and sort of telling us, you know, it's just, you know, a little bit of tinkering here and there, and we're on the right track. Sachs writing a very important book along those notes, and now we're seeing some of their mea culpas, and it's coming out in the form of criticism of the recent plans to correct the financial sector. And so Sachs writes an article for Huffington Post called "The Geithner-Summers Plan is Even Worse Than We Thought." Hmm. And I think the thing I like about it is now we're seeing these economists actually show some respect to their readers by indulging them in trying to actually explain what's going on. And so he provides a scenario whereby these big banks can game this new system in order to get taxpayers to cover about more than 90% of the cost of them selling off these toxic assets, as they're calling them, which really are notes that are worth nothing. So it's basically, he describes an incredibly vicious transfer of wealth that this Geithner-Summers plan will promote.
So respect for the readers, and also it sounds like you like the piece because it's fairly honest.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think when I say respect for the readers, I think it's very important if our goal is to come out of this with a more democratic financial system, the first thing we need is the people who know about it, who've been involved in it, to start telling us what it is.
Right.
And that's the first step.
So it's interesting you say that, because when we have reporters on the show who focus on the economy, they often say that it's such a complex issue that it's difficult to explain. And then we often hear from Media Matters, for example, saying that on television, specifically the Sunday shows, it's very rare for them to even have an economist on the show.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think it totally boils down to respect. I don't think it is that difficult. And I think that this Sachs article shows clearly how easily he's able to explain. His example only takes up two paragraphs. And at the end of it, your jaw's on the floor.
All right, so kudos to Jeffrey Sachs for writing, "The Geithner Summers Plan is even worse than we thought." That's over at the Huffington Post, and we'll put a link on Your Call Radio right after the show. Thanks for that one, Jesse. Dave Zirin, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I saw a brilliant front page story for the LA Times about the new hit NBC show Southland, which just absolutely cut to the matter of why NBC is your home for good late-night television.
Okay.
That was a joke. Let me explain that.
Okay.
That was a joke. I think I heard you take a deep intake of breath for a second.
Well,
there.
I've never heard of Southland.
Oh, well, it's a new show. No, that was a joke because that's actually a big story, is that the LA Times accepted advertising money from NBC to do a big front-page article on the top flap on Thursday about the new NBC show Southland, which looked like an article.
Wow.
With a bold headline and Southland, the new hit show on NBC, as if it was an LA Times article. And more than 100 staffers actually signed a petition. More than 100 writers for the LA Times signed a petition objecting to the LA Times doing an advertisement in such a way. So I was merely making a joke. But if you don't know the context, it's just not funny. So instead, I will say what actually I did think was a good article this week. One, an article that wasn't an advertisement.
Okay.
And that was a terrific piece that was in The Nation, which was called "Why Vermont's Marriage Equality Matters" by Michael Corcoran. And I know this is something you're going to talk about later in the show, but I really like this article by Michael Corcoran because there's been a lot in the news media about what makes the Vermont victory different for gay marriage, because it was won legislatively, and how that kind of turns the conservatives into pretzels because they can't quite make the activist judges argument. But Michael Corcoran, his article also is rooted in the grassroots movement aspect of it, because it wasn't just that it was a legislative victory. They were able to overcome the veto power of the governor of the state, Governor Douglas. And the way they did it was through grassroots activism and through pressuring of elected officials. And going through that process step by step, I thought Michael Corcoran did a great service to the movement, because I do think it charts a way forward for other states, that it's not about relying on judges, it's not about relying on legislatures. It is still, at the end of the day, like any reform, a product of grassroots activity.
And that was in The Nation.
Yeah, Michael Corcoran.
Yeah, and we are going to talk about this later in the show when Rekha Basu joins us from the Des Moines Register. But just briefly, I mean, it's interesting because Sweden just legalized same-sex marriage.
Yeah, and I live in Washington, D.C., and they also just voted here. It got very little publicity, but to recognize marriages from these states that have taken that step with full benefits, full rights, full hospital visits, all the things that make this issue so important. I'm not just going to say to the LGBT community, but to people who believe in some basic sense of justice community, the justice community. Let me just say that, like the idea that you can visit a loved one in the hospital, or the idea that you can leave an inheritance to your 10-year-old child, and little things like that. And I'll tell you, in D.C., it's a little bit gummed up, because with us here, you know, the federal government can always step in and say, gee, you wanted that money for your public schools? Well, you better rescind that gay marriage thing you just did if you want to see a cent of it. I mean, that's what happened here with medical marijuana. That's what's happened here with a whole host of referendums and local initiatives over the years. But it's going to be very interesting, because now you have a Democratic Congress, and that Democratic Congress in no way, shape, or form stands resolutely on the side of gay marriage. But now they're actually going to be pushed to not only be against gay marriage, but also be against the basic tenets of democracy if they overturn what the D.C. Council did.
Right. And it's been interesting also to hear people in California respond to what happened in Iowa. And
you're not used to being to the right of Iowa.
No, not at all. But we'll talk to Rekha about that later. And also, you know, she says that a number of the plaintiffs actually thanked the media because they are actually putting a human face on this story. And that's kind of a switch from what we see. So thanks for that one, Dave. So kudos to The Nation for writing about why marriage equality
component
in Vermont.
That's what to me made it good.
The grassroots component. And then we'll talk to Rekha about grassroots in Iowa. So, Dave, let's start off talking about your latest piece. You're the first ever sports writer for The Nation magazine. And first off, talk about what approach you take, because my brother's a huge sports fan, not very political, and I often send him your articles, and I gave him your book, and he said, "You're having a sports writer on your show today?"
Oh, has he read the book? That should be my
I think he just started it.
Okay, good. Well, you tell your brother that if he ever wants to get in touch over email and talk, I'd be happy to talk to him. I love this beat that I'm on here because I grew up loving sports, and I think politics, it's not about liking or hating politics, is that politics is like oxygen. I mean, you kind of have to either choose to breathe or not breathe. And I think too often, certainly people on the left act like sports is something that people should be ashamed to like, or that it somehow belongs in this right-wing repository that we dare not talk about. And far too many people on the left, like they come up to me sometimes at book readings and they say things like, I just want you to know I really like sports. I mean, as if they're passing me a note under a bathroom stall or something. And I'm like, look, I'm not going to sell you drugs. You don't have to whisper to me. And they really do act like watching sports is something that's only suitable to do at 3 o'clock in the morning in your bathroom with the door closed. And it's not that way. Sports has been part of the human experience as long as there's been humanity, as long as human beings have been able to clothe and feed themselves, no matter what country, no matter what culture. And yes, there is tons of right-wing dross in the professional sports world, but that's all the more important for people who consider themselves progressives to have something to say about it and actually fight to reclaim sports.
Well, I really enjoyed your latest piece, The Meaning of Michigan State, because you really talk about the connection between, well, the winning team in this case, and also just unemployment, how sports can play a role that's positive, really bringing light to a city hit especially hard by the economy. Yeah. And a city that's often stereotyped in the media.
Absolutely. And I was just in Detroit, and there's no question Detroit is feeling tough times. Another media issue we could be talking about also, I know there's so many for you to choose from, but they're closing 23 schools in Detroit. Mm-hmm. That was just announced yesterday. And this is a city that has gone a generational journey from union jobs to service industry jobs to no jobs.
And this is 23 schools just in Detroit?
Just in Detroit. Huh. Just in Detroit. And it's a function of a city that's been both depopulated, and when you couple that with the budget crisis, that's where it's being taken out of. And meanwhile, Rick Wagner, who a lot of people sort of shed tears over, including the Democratic governor, because Obama gave him his walking papers, he's the CEO of General Motors, he had a $20 million golden parachute
right.
Walking away, yet they're closing 23 schools. But I'll tell you, it's like sometimes sports can serve as almost a grotesque distraction, but sometimes sports can serve as something that actually makes people stand up and walk a little bit straighter. And I think it's an open question. You have to judge them game by game, championship by championship, of how sports and politics intersect. It's complicated. And in this case, you had a team from Michigan State that made this run to play in Detroit at Ford Field in front of the largest crowd in the history of the NCAA Final Four. And I was amazed just looking at message boards around the country about how many sports fans were writing things like, yeah, I'm losing my job, or I lost my job, and this has actually given me a lift to see them put their shoulder to it and actually, you know, upset these number one seeds and doing it in Michigan. And a lot of the players, too, like, they're from Michigan because it's this big state school, and their family members have lost jobs in Michigan, and they were telling those stories to the press. So this wasn't a bread and circus type of situation, like, oh, look at the shiny sporting event while we forget about our problems. It actually served to amplify it in a powerful way.
And you write that the play-by-play announcer, Jim Nantz, said the state has been hit especially hard. They are trying to find a way to make so many people happy, talking about Michigan State players.
And this is Jim Nantz, who plays golf with George H.W. Bush. So, I mean, that's true. And so if you do get to this situation where you cannot deny the truth of what's happening in this country, and a sporting event can have the power to amplify those realities for a national audience instead of covering them up.
Did if you don't mind me asking, did CBS do any personal interest sort of stories at halftime or anything along those lines?
And, you know, that's a great question. We have to take a quick break, and we'll get an answer from Dave Zirin right after the break. That's Dave Zirin. We're also joined by Jesse Freestone with The Real News Network. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, and the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable is now being rebroadcast on KALW at 5 p.m. Left, Right, and Center and Counterspin, previously heard at the 5 o'clock hour, are moving back to 7 o'clock, immediately following Fresh Air, right here at 91.7. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we will continue our new series talking about how we can create the economy we want by focusing on small businesses. A recent poll found that about 80% of all small businesses have been hit hard by the economic recession. Not a surprise, really, but we'll be talking about how these small businesses are adapting, what resources are available to them. If you own a small business, we'd love to hear from you on Monday. And if you're making the decision to shop small in these times, we'd also love to hear from you. And then on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with San Francisco Unified's Superintendent Carlos Garcia. What are the challenges facing today's big city superintendents of schools as we're seeing resources cut drastically? And Thursday, Michelle Goldberg will be here. She's out with a new book called The Means of Production, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, every Friday on Your Call, we connect you with reporters to talk about coverage of the week's news. And today we're joined by Dave Zirin. He is the first ever sports writer for The Nation magazine. He also hosts XM Satellite's weekly show, Edge of Sports, and he's author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. We're also joined by Jesse Freestein. He covers the military and weapons budget, where he's been covering that for the Real News Network. He recently returned from El Salvador, where he was covering the elections there. And you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also join us. It's a toll-free call at 866-798-8255. If you'd like to talk about any kind of sports coverage, do you see, Jesse asked a good question before the break, are these stories being played out in the sort of traditional sports coverage? Do they take a look at job creation and just what sports really does in a city, for example, like Detroit, that has been hit so hard by the economy? Have you seen any of those connections made if you're a sports fan? And a little later on the show, we'll be talking about the military and weapons budget, if you'd like to talk about coverage of that. And then Rekha Basu will join us in about 10 minutes to talk about coverage of gay marriage in Iowa. And the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. So, Dave, when you look at more traditional sports coverage, are you finding that they're making the connections between sports and employment and really giving people some hope at a time when the economy is doing so bad in a place like Detroit?
Oh, wow. Probably an overstatement to say that it's happening in a generalized way across the board. But when you have areas that are hit particularly hard by crisis, and when you have a confluence of events like the Final Four game being in Detroit and Michigan State doing, even though they were a number two seed, a rather improbable run, I think you get a situation where it becomes impossible to ignore. It becomes the story in and of itself. And I really do think it became the story, not so much because we're all looking sort of down on Michigan and marveling at its resilience in the face of crisis. I think it has less to do with that and more to do with that the Flint experience and the Michigan experience is becoming a national experience. I mean, we look at Michigan, we used to see our past, you know, the auto industry and aging infrastructure. Now we look at Michigan and we see our present and maybe our future. And I think that's what gave it a special resonance. It's not that Michigan in and of itself is having hard times. It's that it's really the tip of the spear.
And also, I wanted to ask you about coverage of the Yankees' new stadium. It cost a whopping $1.5 billion. USA Today called it a palace. And then the Mets also opened a new stadium, Citi Field, which is named for Citibank. And I went to a Giants game the other night and noticed that Bank of America logos were all over the place. And, of course, TARP immediately came to my mind. So talk about the coverage between sort of the sports pages and the business pages. What really stands out for you?
Well, what stands out for me is a disconnect there because everybody knows the sports industry is in serious financial straits right now. I mean, it's going the way of banking. It's going the way of retail. It's going the way of the auto industry. And I think, you know, the idea of commissioners at Capitol Hill lining up for their bailout isn't as far-fetched as it may sound. I mean, they may be laughed out of Capitol Hill, especially when you consider the amount of the public subsidies they've gotten over the years. But it's a reality that there is a serious financial problem in sports right now, a serious financial problem of how they're going to see themselves getting through this recession. And at the same time, to have that concurrent, to have the banking industry at the heart of these two massive stadium projects in New York City is something that people in New York are repulsed about. And it's something that's something that's not going to go away because They're going to keep needing money for that Yankee Stadium, and the more money they get, the more money is going to be taken out of a city that infrastructure is just in dire need of repair at this point.
When you say massive budget cuts, what do you mean by that, affecting sports?
Oh, by massive budget cuts in sports, what I mean is that each and every sport is dealing with its own financial crisis right now. The NFL and the NBA have both laid off a ton of their corporate offices. The Major League Baseball, I mean, there was a game last summer that had 500 fans at it in Florida. And each of these sports has sort of like a crisis of overproduction. Too many sports, too many teams, too many games, and not enough disposable income because they've spent the last generation building the economy of sports on publicly funded stadiums, on sweetheart PSLs, personal seat licenses, and luxury boxes, and on these cable deals. And all three of those things are in serious jeopardy in a recession climate.
Jesse, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, it just seems like it's a question of how much is hope worth to you, and it seems like at what point do you cut these projects? I know, for example, in Canada, there's a big issue right now with funding for the 2010 Olympics.
That's right.
They're massively over budget. Not to mention there's been a huge anti-Olympic movement that's taken root out there for various of the other ill effects that it has on the environment, on the indigenous population, and on criminalization of the homelessness problem in Vancouver, which is a real issue there, and rezoning and things. And so, yeah, so at what point does the public or does its elected officials actually decide that it's not worth it and take the hope hit for the cause of dedicating that money to maybe more productive.
It totally speaks for us to be as educated as possible as to what kind of economic stimulus we want to see, because I know in Chicago there's also a movement to keep the Olympics from coming there in 2016. And there's actually some wonderful connections that have developed between the Vancouver 2010 folks and the Chicago 2016 folks and people working together. And the argument that's coming back from the city is, well, look, it's fine and good for you to say you don't want the Olympics in the good times, but this is a recession, and the Olympics mean construction jobs. It means stadium projects. It means putting people to work. And that's also really a false argument.
Right, because it also, in most cases, means a huge municipal debt.
Exactly, exactly. And it also means jobs, of course, that aren't continued. Because say you build your luge facility, I mean, you're probably not going to say, "Gee, let's re-up and you know make sure that luge facility is up to code." No, what's going to happen is it's going to just sort of molt and rust. Although I like a good luge, don't get me wrong.
Well, and Dave, it seems like you know people like David K. Johnston talk about subsidies given to the ballparks, and he finds a direct correlation between subsidies given to ballparks and crime increasing in low-income neighborhoods, where some of that money could have been used for maybe an after-school program.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you think about it, stadium funding over the last 25 years has substituted for anything resembling an urban policy in the United States. That's been the cure-all for the problems of depopulated urban centers. I mean, we were just talking about Detroit. Detroit's gone from a city of about 3 million people to under 900,000 people, and in that time, there have been two huge stadium projects in the city, Ford Field and Comerica Park. And it hasn't. All it does when those stadium projects are built are create destination points for people coming in from the suburbs. And the worst thing about stadium projects is, say, take a football stadium like Ford Field. It's in use 8 days a year, 8 Sundays a year, 8 out of 365 days. And when you consider, you know, people like to joke about Americans being just a bunch of, you know, sports-loving yahoos. More people go to museums in a given year than go to sporting events in this country. And you think about, museums, you know, that's not a big PR. You know, there's no museum section of your local paper.
Does that count the Hall of Fames, though?
That does not count the Hall of Fames.
Okay.
Very good point. Shout out to the Hall of Fame. But the basics of, like, what actually will bring people on a consistent 365-day basis and what won't. I mean, stadiums just fail miserably. And, yeah, rise in crime, cut back in facilities. I mean, as these two stadiums have been built in Detroit, they've closed down 9 youth centers over the same time.
And then also ensuring that it's affordable for everyone to actually enjoy the game.
Which doesn't happen. I mean, one of the great ironies of Hurricane Katrina, when the Superdome became the homeless shelter from hell, was that for many of the people, there was actually a study that was done for just about all the people that were needing to use the Superdome as a cover and a shelter. It was the first time the overwhelming majority of them had ever even been inside the doors, even though they had paid for it in the first place, or their families had when it was built 30 years earlier. Mm.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's our Friday Media Roundtable. Every Friday, we connect you with reporters to talk about coverage of the week's news, and the voice you just heard there is Dave Zirin. He's the first ever sports writer for The Nation magazine. He also hosts XM Satellite's weekly show, Edge of Sports Radio. He's got a blog by the same name. He's also author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. And we are joined by Jesse Freestin. He covers the military-industrial complex for the Real News Network. That's an independent news and documentary network. Jesse also recently returned from El Salvador, where he was covering the elections there. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're going to be talking now about the military and weapons budget, and I'd love to hear from those of you who've read coverage about this, maybe if you saw some TV pieces. What did you think of the coverage? Did it go deep enough to talk about what weapons programs are being cut? And then also, did you hear about many of the politicians whose constituents have jobs in these weapons factories and what sort of fight is to come in Congress? 866-798-8255. In about 10 minutes or 15 minutes, we'll talk about coverage of gay marriage in Iowa and across the country. You can also join us via email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's switch gears here and talk about coverage of the military and weapons budget that was announced on Wednesday by Secretary Robert Gates. And Jesse, before we dive in and talk about coverage, let's play a clip. I think this kind of gives us a good sense of how TV reporters and hosts are covering this. This was from Wednesday's Daily Show, and this is called Full Metal Budget.
The defense secretary takes an axe to some key Pentagon programs.
Drastic cuts in the military budget.
Steep budget cuts.
The Pentagon pushing forward, cutting costs and ditching weapons.
Huge slashes to the Pentagon's budget.
That's a clip from Wednesday's Daily Show. So, Jesse, huge budget cuts to the military budget based on these TV reports.
Yeah, well, once again, the media has really shown its colors. The budget that is proposed by President Obama and Secretary Gates is $20 billion more than anything Bush ever proposed. And that's a 4% increase, given that it's the largest budget item in the United States. It only represents 4%, $20 billion. Now, the interesting thing about this is we saw a moment here, given that for the past, since World War II, the military budget has been something just generally not spoken about, particularly since the 80s. You had the fiscal conservatives under Reagan talking about how Reagan cut budgets, but their mathematics always excluded the military because budgets actually went up under Reagan, but domestic spending went down. And so now we see, and in this moment of, after budgets have almost doubled under Bush, military budgets have seen skyrocketing. And we saw this moment, right, where all these things coming together, an economic crisis, massive, massive domestic needs for fiscal stimulus, and a president coming to power, the media telling that the nation's screaming change, all these things coming together, and what do we get? A net increase on the military budget. And I think it just serves to show exactly how strong this military-industrial complex, as we refer to it, is. We saw everything line up to protect it, from massive lobbying spending. We saw, senators like Carl Levin, representing districts that have massive, massive domestic needs for jobs and for infrastructure development and all this money, standing up and defending this budget. And then we see the media come in and play its role to a way that I've never seen. It's just amazing. I mean, you talked about the Wall Street Journal's headline. It was actually Obama and Gates gut the military budget, like as if with reckless abandon they just went in there with a red pen and just started Xing things off.
Yeah. So how do you explain this? Because you've got the Wall Street Journal, and then you've got the Financial Times headline saying Gates takes on the defense industry. Uh-huh. And then we heard the clips of CNN, everyone from CNN to Fox to CBS, saying uh-huh. that there's huge, massive cuts coming to the budget, military budget. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, there is... To credit here, or whatever side position you take on this, there is a cut of a major program, and that's the F-22. So this is a plane that, when you include all the costs, was running about $340 million per plane. And so that program is being cut. And Lockheed is the major, Lockheed Martin, the world's number one defense contractor, is the major company involved in the production of that plane.
And when you say being cut, what does that mean? Because Gates also said that there's the F-35 that's kind of like the smaller, I guess the younger brother to the F-22.
Yeah.
And the ultimate plan is to buy 2,443 F-35s. And how much is the F-35?
The F-35, if I don't get me wrong here, is about $35 million a plane or something along the lines.
Okay, $35 million.
I mean, 2,400 planes. the United States is already the largest air force in the world. If I'm not wrong, by over twice the next largest, and in the process of ordering 2,400 planes, and also this F-22, which has never been used. It's meant to have air superiority over the next generation of what they'd expected the Soviet Union's Air Force would have been. Of course, hasn't been developed. So the next generation makes this was going to be above that and ahead of that. And we're going to end up with 190 of those nonetheless.
Now, sticking with this F-22, what I've noticed in media coverage is that editorials actually go beneath the headline. So, for example, the Christian Science Monitor has an editorial today saying, over the decades, the defense industry has spread into so many congressional districts that it's virtually impossible to shut anything down without a battle cry from key lawmakers. The targeted F-22 fighter jet, for instance, is assembled with components built in 44 states.
That's right. What we see here is an industry which has had no impetus whatsoever to try and check costs and has developed fully around the idea of maintaining itself for the sake of maintaining itself. It doesn't take an economist. We don't need Jeffrey Sachs to write an article about how making parts in 44 states isn't economical. It's absolutely ridiculous, and that creates another huge problem in terms of if we look further down the road about the possibility of transforming this massive production capacity that the U.S. has to make war weapons into making domestic needs, is that these companies aren't ready to bid on making wind turbines because they don't know how to cut costs. In fact, there's tons of insider stories of them making superfluous things in December and in at the end of the fiscal years, so that they can justify making another bid the next year for the same amount of money or more. It's really something. It has a life unto its own.
So some of the other programs that will be slashed, the missile defense programs will be slashed by $1.4 billion. A new set of transport helicopters for President Obama got axed, $13 billion.
The big laser on the plane, too, right?
Yeah, the big laser. The one that Lieberman was so...
He was very sad. Yeah. I want my laser.
Yeah, and in fact, for those of you who have internet access, you've got to watch this Daily Show clip. We'll put it on the website after the show. And Jesse, how important is it in articles for reporters to point out that the U.S. spends nearly as much on the military and weapons as every other country on Earth combined?
How important is that?
Yeah, how important is that? Because that was missing from a lot of the pieces that I read.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, I imagine anybody who just heard that for the first time is... sitting there thinking, how important is that? I mean, that's something. What is the function of a military? Is it for defense needs? Because if it's for defense needs, if the whole rest of the world isn't, you know, have plans getting together to invade you, then you don't need to be spending more than the rest of the world. So I think we need to get into a broader question here. What is the function of a military? And so in that light, we've seen in this, as I was talking about, this sort of confluence of events of a new president coming to power, the world on so many people's lips, and an economic crisis. There's been no talk about the fact that, you know, Obama wants to and ran on this, and it was very little talked about during the campaign, is that he wants to increase the size of the military,
mm-hmm.
which won't have any trouble in an economic crisis. Recruitment numbers are already going through the roof. There's no talk about the fact that the U.S. maintains in between 700 and 1,000 military bases outside of its borders, not including Iraq and Afghanistan.
And this costs almost $100 billion a year?
Roughly $100 billion a year, based on estimates by Miriam Pemberton, who is a military analyst at the Institute for Policy Studies.
And you interviewed her for the piece you did for the Real News Network.
Right.
Dave Zirin, do you want to jump in here? Jesse brings up a question about the media really asking this important question, what is the function of a military? And then last week when we talked about Afghanistan, our guest said that the media needs to bring up the very important question, what is the Obama administration's plan in Afghanistan? Why are they increasing troop sizes? What's their end game here? Have you seen those questions being raised?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen them being raised nearly enough. And unfortunately, when they do get raised, they get raised in a manner that I don't think actually helps us elucidate and answer the questions. I mean, I think I'm not the only person out there who's crying for an independent press that exists on the network and corporate level. I mean, but it's almost a contradiction. See, I want an independent press on the corporate level. But you either get highly partisan news that's tied to a different political faction, or you get the sort of mainstream blather that just like Wolf Blitzer saying, oh, the defense spending is up, defense spending is being cut, drastic cuts in defense, and not enough taking a step back and trying to do what I know you do, what Amy Goodman does, and ask the very basic questions like, so why are we in Afghanistan? Our troop hikes really what's going to do it? Is this current strategy with regards to our military actually serve the interests of global peace, or does it just actually accentuate and deepen the question of war? I mean, because we don't ask these questions, we don't get political leaders who are forced to try to answer those questions, and I think we get then the same myopic policies.
Well, because the budget just came out, and also President Obama has requested an additional $75.5 billion in war funds, since you just brought up politicians, California Democratic Representative Lynn Woolsey says that she will not vote for this. So we're starting to see the first splits between Congress and the White House.
Right. I'd like to see who else is going to join her on that. But it is something, though. I mean, tell me this just doesn't sound like deja vu all over again, this idea of $83 billion in discretionary funding to make sure that the wars were still going on. I remember every time Bush asked for one of those high double-digit in the billions numbers as the years went on, I mean, people, there was a lot of cry, a lot of outrage.
And I got to tell you, it is refreshing, Jesse, to see people at least talking about the military budget right now.
That is true.
And for example, back in September when early October, when the economic crisis had just hit and all the talk was about Paulson and this $700 billion to Wall Street and this heated debate over that, the end line of the budget process came to a fruition with a $640 billion military spending bill.
Well, I think there's a greater sense that this is really our bill right now.
Yeah.
And every dollar that's being spent is a dollar that belongs to us.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's one of the – if we can build a political movement out of it, I think there's a chance to really accentuate people's feeling of ownership, whether it's the banks or the military or what have you. Because I know people are feeling like, well, if they're going to spend this much money, we need to see something back for it.
And there is an opportunity here for a really interesting alliance. I mean, at the turn of the 20th century, Mark Twain was actually the leader of something called the Anti-Imperialist League, I believe, if I have it correctly. And it was a left-right coalition. Because there's a lot of voices on the right, the libertarian voices, the Ron Paul movement, millions of people on the right who are against this, and millions of people on the left as well, who have some of which have rallied behind Barney Frank and his demands to cut the budget by 25%. And so I really think there's an interesting opportunity if people can maybe in the short run get past some of their differences to get together on this one.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Your Call, and today is our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we connect you with reporters to discuss coverage of the week's news. And the voice you just heard there is Jesse Freestin. He's been covering the military and weapons budget for the Real News Network. That's an independent TV news and documentary network. And we're joined by Dave Zirin, the first ever sports writer for The Nation magazine. He is also host of XM's weekly radio show, Edge of Sports, and author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. And now I would like to welcome Rekha Basu to the show. Rekha is a columnist with the Des Moines Register, and she has been writing about and following coverage of the gay marriage ruling, the decision that came down last Friday. Hi, Rekha. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, Iowa Gay marriage is now legal in Iowa. A lot of people in California were sort of scratching their heads saying, hey, what happened to California?
Well, a lot of people in Iowa were doing this.
I'm sure.
We were feeling pretty glowy about it and very heady, I must say. It isn't officially legal yet. I think the ruling actually takes effect on the 27th of April, but I have a bunch of friends who are planning weddings right now.
Wow, so people can start getting married later this month.
Exactly, later this month.
So right. You've been writing about this in your column from a personal perspective. Also, talk about something you said before the show really struck me, and that is that the plaintiffs, they found out about the decision in the same room as the media, and they actually thanked reporters for putting a human face on this story.
That's exactly right. First of all, just to sort of create the climate a little bit, this decision, and this speaks to what's happened to traditional media, the Supreme Court was scheduled to release its decision at 8:30 in the morning, but they were going to do it on their website, not by convening, not in a courtroom. So what happened is there were like over a million people logged onto the website and the whole system crashed. So it was impossible. There were so many people waiting for this decision, but nobody was able to get it. So people had to run over to the Supreme Court and get written copies of the decision. The attorneys from Lambda Legal, who paid for the lawsuit basically with these six plaintiffs, had kept the plaintiffs sequestered in a private room so that they wouldn't be hearing the decision until they were in the presence of the press. So all of us in the press already knew it. We were taken to a hotel room, a conference room, where they were gathered for press conference, and it was announced. And I must say, it was an incredible moment. I mean, there was a lot of crying, a lot of hugging each other, just huge emotions, a lot of yelps and so on. And then each of the six couples who had sued got up and shared a few words about themselves, their plans, and gave thanks and so on. And one of them thanked the media for having covered their stories. And I think it's actually a really interesting thing, the role of the media in something like this, because both sides have such different views about it. For the plaintiffs, the sort of normalization of gay life, the telling of the stories of gay couples who have been together for decades, who have children together, who have raised kids together, who are denied the right to marry, who have been discriminated against, who couldn't visit each other in a hospital room because they didn't have legal standing. Those kinds of things were such an important way of moving society, Iowans, forward on this issue. And conversely, for the other side, and primarily for Republicans who oppose same-sex marriage in the state, they felt that we in the press did a real destructive thing by normalizing same-sex relationships and the notion of same-sex marriage. So I think that the role of the media here has been really significant and really critical. I actually moved to Iowa from New York some 18 years ago, and from that time on, I had always written a lot about gay rights issues back in New York, and I started writing about it a lot here. And at the time, most gay people I knew were very closeted, and there was very little discussion about anything to do with being gay. In that time, there's been a dramatic sea change, I think, culturally in people's awareness and understanding of it. And even our polls show that. I think in 1996, only 9% of people favored the idea of same-sex marriage, and now it's more than 30%. And I think a lot of that has had to do with the press, with the media, with telling those stories.
What are you hearing from reporters as the plaintiffs praise them, and then you have people on the other side criticizing the coverage?
Well, yeah. I mean, one thing that's happened is we have a reporter here. His name is Jason Clayworth. He's very good. He covers the state capitol. He's openly gay. And there is a Republican website, kind of a blog, that has started to criticize the Register for having a gay person report on the same-sex marriage issue, even though that's his beat. His beat is the Capitol, and he's not done it in any kind of a biased way. This web has raised questions about whether it is appropriate for someone who has a direct interest in an issue to be able to appropriately and objectively write about it. And, you know, quite frankly, I think the whole argument is completely bogus, because by that token, you wouldn't have black people covering the black community. You wouldn't have people of South Asian descent being foreign correspondents in India. You wouldn't have anyone that actually has a firsthand involvement or understanding of an issue being part of the coverage of it. So I think it's ridiculous, but I think that they're actually looking, you know, the opponents are really looking for angles. And I think that the Register is actually a real lightning rod at this point, because we're perceived as being very, very liberal and very pro-gay.
Dave Zirin brought up an article earlier in the show in The Nation about Vermont, marriage equality in Vermont, and it really focused on the power of the grassroots and activism.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing coverage of that in Iowa?
Well, yeah. I mean, the activism has really sprung up very recently, but again, because this was a court case rather than something on which people had to vote, it came about in a different way.
Right.
There have been pockets of activism here, but this ruling was really about sort of legal arguments. At the same time that you know, sort of gay activists in Iowa were preparing for the Supreme Court ruling, one organization by the name of One Iowa became quite prominent and has been doing a lot to bring this issue, keep this issue in the forefront. And also what we've been seeing have been lobby days at the state capitol in anticipation of the ruling. Actually, back in February, a number of activists went to the capitol and met with lawmakers and shared their stories just to try to prepare the climate for if the Supreme Court did rule the way it has, and to try and prevent them from taking any steps like voting for a constitutional amendment, which would be the next option and really the only other option available to opponents at this point.
And we have a question from a caller about the ruling. So let's hear from Vasily in Kensington.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Vasily.
Hi. My question is, was the basis for the ruling in Iowa, was it that separate but equal is not good enough? Was that the basis that this was the precedent established during the civil rights problems, that you can have a civil marriage and it might provide the same perks as a regular marriage, but it violates a separate but equal is no good kind of idea?
Actually, the issue of civil unions never came up. That was not a part of this case, because we don't have civil unions in Iowa either. So it was, the ruling was on either marriage or no marriage. So actually, there was no question of separate but equal. There was nothing available for same-sex couples that was legally recognized. And the Iowa Constitution turns out to be really a very progressive document, and actually quite a lot more liberal than many other state constitutions, which is why this could happen in Iowa. The justices said that the Iowa Constitution provides equal rights regardless of sex to marry, provides the right of marriage to everybody. And the Iowa Supreme Court has actually been on the forefront of a lot of groundbreaking kind of societal changes, from striking down slavery back in 1839 to, you know, segregation, anti-segregation votes. We were the first state to allow women to practice law. So it's really in keeping with a history of very progressive rulings by the court.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Vasily. Let's next hear from Craig in San Leandro. Hi, Craig. Thank you for holding.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I have three questions, one for each of your guests. I used to play hoop against Dr. J when I was in college, and I was part of the anti-war movement. And my second cousin was at one time the significant other of Ellen DeGeneres. But in terms of sports question, you know, I thought for a long time that these exorbitant sports salaries almost justified CEO salaries. And the thing about the military is that, you know, we talk about the military budget in relation to the rest of the world, but actually the breakdown per country is pretty interesting. China, we spent $660 billion on military. China spent $60 billion. Russia, $50 billion. England, France, and Japan in the low 40s, Germany 32, and Italy 28. If we looked at it from that perspective, I mean, why are we footing the bill for so much military while the rest of the world is paying so much less? And, you know, in terms of what's really interesting in Vermont is Vermont was such a small place. They have 150 legislators in a state with only 660,000 people. In California, we have almost, one assembly person per 400,000 or 500,000 people. So that was a problem in California. But it was a tremendous victory. And, you know, in a state that size, it's a lot easier to do grassroots work.
And Craig, since you were holding so long, do you have a media question that we can get to?
Well, the media thing was, you know, that in the media they don't cover, you know, what other countries are spending on military. If people saw that, they think that it's really exorbitant that we spend, you know, we spend 660 versus China, which is four times our size, which only spends like $60 billion, and Russia spends $55 billion. I mean, it's like going out to a restaurant and always paying for the bill.
Yeah, well, it's a good show idea. I'll add it to our list. Thank you, Craig. Thanks for calling in. We're almost out of time, but Jesse, just briefly, I'm sorry we didn't get to spend more time on this. You just returned from El Salvador, where you were covering the elections there. On March 15th, El Salvador made history by electing the first left-wing president. Just give us some thoughts on what you saw and what really stood out in terms of media coverage.
Well, briefly, what I saw, I guess, was for the first time in the history of that country, a portion of the population, now the majority, getting to participate. And we've really seen a right wing there that's been in power, depending on who you speak to in the streets of El Salvador. Some will say 500 years, some will say 200 years, and some will point to this most recent government of 20 years since the end of the Civil War, since 2 years before the end of the Civil War. And I guess in the media coverage, an abundance of energy there. And in the media coverage, the thing that that was really striking was how there's a tendency in the English language media to attribute anything that happens in Latin America that can be labeled leftist to some sort of pink wave, some sort of easy to digest metaphor, to Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian revolution. If you talk to people in the streets of El Salvador, Hugo Chavez's name will not come up when you're asking why they voted for the FMLN. And in the process of breaking it down to these transnational movements, whether or not they exist, you lose the real details, the real stuff that makes up these changes in these countries.
And Jesse, we only have about 15 seconds, but also in a switch in administrations, I understand the Obama administration took a neutral role in this.
Right. So in the 2004 election, the Bush government actually threatened Salvadoran immigrants their right to stay in this country, their temporary protected status, as well as their ability to send home money to their family members, which accounts for 20% of El Salvador's GDP.
All right. And Jesse, I'm so sorry to cut you off. We're out of time, but we will have you back to talk about coverage in El Salvador, because I know you spent a lot of time there. That's Jesse Freestin with the Real News Network. Also, Dave Zirin, first-ever sports writer with The Nation magazine. And Rekha Basu, a columnist with the Des Moines Register. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thanks for listening. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up on Monday. How are small businesses coping with the economic crisis? On the next Your Call, we continue our Monday series on how we can create the economy we want by focusing on small businesses. A recent American City Business Journal poll found that 86% of small businesses have been hit by the recession. If you own a small business, what changes have you made? You can join us by phone or email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Are you shopping small to ensure the local business in your area survives? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find a link to the Your Call podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, we'll talk with Congressional Black Caucus Chair Barbara Lee about her recent trip to Cuba and her hopes for the future of U.S.-Cuba relations. Dr. Cornel West grades the international debut of President Barack Obama. Plus, soul singer Eric Benet stops by to share his musical insights on love and life on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up at 1 o'clock here on KALW, San Francisco. It's new time on Fridays on your local public radio station. And you can listen on the web at kalw.org. But coming up next, it's New America Now with Sandeep Roy.